In this podcast, I'm going to talk about weird and wacky target markets for financial advisors, also called financial advisor niche markets. Hey, what's up, party people? It's me, Sarah G with the Smack, and I'm back. I am a CFA charter holder, and I used to be a financial advisor. On this podcast, I provide non-BS oriented, straight up views on LinkedIn and other financial advisor marketing topics. You can't get this anywhere else, people. So if that's of value, then please subscribe. And if not, then please leave this podcast right now. And I know that this is something that marketing consultants love talking to you financial advisors about. I'm not just going to talk to you about establishing a niche market. I'm going to talk to you about establishing a weird niche market. And there are definitely benefits to that that I'm going to go over. First of all, what is a target market for a financial advisor? A target market is a group of people who share a common characteristic. There's usually one predominant trait that defines the categorization of the group. These are also called niche markets. Now, what I think a lot of advisors have a problem with is when they go into a state of specificity and give up the generalization, right? The general marketing, the idea of like not having as much focus on a group of people, they worry that they're going to lose people. And I say, you may or you may not. Somebody may go to your website and say, you're focused on tech employees. I'm a pharmaceutical rep. You're not right for me. I'm not going to lie and say that that can't happen. Absolutely, it can happen. But what I'm saying to you is, I want you to think about the opportunity. I want you to think about what you're giving up about losing that random client and the gains that you're making by electing to focus on the specific group as outweighing the loss. It may or it may not. It's up to you how well you execute the target market strategy. If you're going to be one of these financial advisors that just goes out there and says, and a lot of them do it just because there are high earning professions and they want to talk to people with a lot of money. There's no mission. There's no spirit behind it. There's no intrigue. There's no real interest. And most of all, there's no real value. What publications do doctors read? Oh, I don't know. Oh, okay. Have you heard of the White Coat Investor? Have you ever gone to that website? That's a financial website that a lot of doctors will go to. Oh, no, I've never heard of that. What are the publications that doctors read? What's their annual conference for the specialty of doctor that you're working with? Oh, I don't know. Or people do this with women. They say, my niche is women. My niche is women. Half the world is a woman, okay? That doesn't make any sense. It's so blah, all right? There's female executives of particular companies of particular types. There's female entrepreneurs of particular business types, okay? All kinds of women in the world. Women is not a niche, folks. So this is what I mean is I'm tired of this lazy, non-specific niche strategy that's not really going to get you anywhere. And yes, in that case, if you're not going to be serious about the niche and go hard and go all in, best that you don't go to the niche anyways. Best, yes, leave it off your website because the gains that you're going to make aren't going to be substantial enough to outweigh the loss of excluding people. Okay, so make it worth the loss due to exclusion. The other thing is, I'm so tired of people focusing on a niche and then having it be like one of these boring, over-marketed niches. There's not a lot of point in that. Like, do you really want to be financial advisor number 5,065 focusing on hiring doctors? Doctors are running in the other direction. They've had every private REIT salesperson, every whole life insurance agent. They get 20 of these messages a day if they're on social media. They are running under a rock to hide from you. It's so tired, okay? Focus on a weird, wacky niche. And don't go in there with your AUM guns blazing. Actually have something of value to offer, especially if you're not going for a particularly high earning niche where people don't have as much potential to accumulate. Go in there with your financial planning hat on, okay? Advice only is a movement where financial planning and advice are provided without managing the assets. I've had some folks on my show talking about that. I'm probably gonna have more in the future. I have information on my website about that. Look at that. And I'm not saying change your whole business model. I mean, if you're starting out, that might be a good way to pursue it, or maybe you're looking to make a conversion focus, whatever, okay? But even if you're not an advice-only advisor or exclusively focused on financial planning, there are many careers where the average income is probably lower, where there's a huge opportunity to go in there and offer these people awesome planning, okay? Because for many of them, that's what they really need if they haven't accumulated assets. I've got some special guests here coming up on my show, but first I'm gonna talk about examples of weird, wacky niches. I think it would be so rare to find a financial advisor who's an expert in every aspect of life for one of the following groups. These are some examples. Psychic mediums. You may say, oh, well, the psychic medium down the street from me probably doesn't make a lot of money. That's probably true. But what about the top earning psychic mediums? Because I've seen some psychic mediums that are, for example, on television. They get booked for shows with full room, okay? Like there was this one, this Long Island medium or whatever that was on, I mean, I think she was on all the talk shows, okay? So, you know, even if the average income is lower and the people maybe haven't accumulated as much or maybe can't readily afford that financial planning fee, you've got to look for the more successful ones, the ones that maybe are earning more, all right? You don't have to do business with every single psychic medium. There's 50 to 70 people that you have to do business with to create a good practice. So you don't need 5,000 of these people. You could focus on the top earning, the most conscientious, the ones that really have an interest and a need, okay? Not everyone is gonna be that way. But I still think you have a better chance of being the one person serving a less high earning niche than, like I said, financial advisor number 5,065 that wants to work with business owners, okay? Here's another one, celebrity personal trainers. I knew a celebrity personal trainer once that owned a real estate on the Hamptons. Okay, we say, oh, this is, you know, they work per hour or they're you know, not highly educated or what. Well, you'd be surprised, all right? Luxury car dealers, research scientists who work in Antarctica. Wouldn't that be great? That'd be so fun. That's the other thing is, don't you think these niches would be fun? When you get one of these weird, wacky niches, here's another example, BMX bikers. So my son has gotten into BMX biking. There's actually a bike course right near our apartment. And so just this last weekend, I was there with all the other parents and I've become like a BMX mom because, you know, the chain breaks or he outgrows his bike or he sees like a competition on YouTube and he wants to go to the competition. And it's like, I'm into it because he's into it, right? So I learn all about these things. And when I'm at the bike course, like every single time I meet somebody, they're so into the culture that I've become into the culture. There's a whole subculture in this BMX biking hobby, okay? So and if you look at it, the really successful BMX bikers are going, they're doing international competitions and they're winning prizes and they're traveling all around the world. It's exciting and fun. So, I mean, if I ever were to have a conversation, if I were a financial advisor and I had a kid that was into BMX biking and I was a BMX mom or dad, I just would think the conversation would be so natural if I met, like, for example, Sam Pilgrim is a famous BMX biker. He has a huge YouTube channel. Like if I ever met Sam Pilgrim, you would see the light shining in my eyes. I would be so excited. And because he's on YouTube, I would like have so much to talk about with him. I'd be like, oh, I loved that video of you doing this or that. And I'd have so many good questions for him because I know his life, okay? So what I'm saying is like, have fun for goodness sake. I hate how in financial planning and advising, there's always this idea of like, would you go in there or anything so serious? I understand this is serious, but why can't you find something that you're passionate about and that people are passionate about and that kind of lives in them and go through it that way? Because it's natural and authentic. I think it'll make it go easier. What do you think? You disagree with me? Another one, this is I've heard of a financial advisor who focuses on just gamers, on famous video gamers. I mean, some of these video gamers on YouTube are making probably $1 million a year or more. I've seen them, all right? Stunt actors, what an interesting little niche. And there are tons of things about that occupation that would make you as a financial advisor very valuable if you became an expert in it, like insurance, like disability, like financial planning for times when maybe cash flow is low and helping them save and encouraging good saving and spend, all of that, okay? This is where you could be so valuable if you really understood the niche. Skydivers, that's another one. And how fun would that be to be like a financial advisor for skydivers? Strippers, here's another one. I remember when I was in my early 20s, I had these kind of like wild random friends, whatever, you know, we were young, we were all out of college. And there was this one girl that we were friends with and she was a stripper. And I remember like, I couldn't beat her in terms of the amount of money I was making. Like I was just starting out in my career in finance. I was taking my CFA, working a million hours. I had this job at JP Morgan and I was earning a decent living for somebody right out of college, but she had like a BMW and she was killing it. This girl was killing it. We kind of lost touch. I mean, that was how long ago? That was probably about 20 years ago now. But my point is that everybody needs financial planning. Everybody needs financial advice. And if you can kind of strip the AUM away and you can go in there and work on some of these niches where people haven't necessarily accumulated all the assets, I think that there's a great opportunity. I have two people that are going to be on the show. I'm going to be interviewing them and they're going to tell you their story of having a weird, wacky niche and how it's worked out for them. And I hope it will inspire you to consider being non-boring and going in this direction. Sure. Todd Cafuri of Cadenza Financial Planning is a financial advisor who lives in Las Vegas and is focused on working with event planners. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sarah. Good to be here.
So, Todd, how did you pick this niche market of event planners?
So it was a convergence of a lot of different things, actually. And, you know, right up front, people have this connotation of event planners as, you know, people who are like wedding planners and things like that. This is not quite the same thing. Event professionals are people who deal with a lot of corporate shows, a lot of professional music performances, any of those sorts of things, and not so much the wedding planning piece of it. There are very technical roles that are within this. There are producer roles that are with, there's content managers, that those are the sorts of, some of the people that are in that event professional industry. I got involved in it sort of in a roundabout way. My wife is actually a live event producer. And when I created Cadenza almost a year ago, my idea was that because she travels so often, shows all over the country, I wanted my firm to be fully virtual so I could travel as well. So that's the way I set it up. And then
That is romantic, dude.
Isn't it? Well, the fact that I get to it's the thing is I don't want to be away for, we don't want to be away from each other for, stretches of time.
On a consistent basis. Yeah, I totally hear you. I love that. Okay, good. So keep going.
Yeah. So I set it up as, basically 100% virtual so I can work with people all around the country. It ties in as well with my enrolled agent designation, which I'm able to, essentially, if I had to represent people all over the country in front of the IRS, not that I really want to, but I can. But it allowed me to go to the different locations where she was going and actually meet a lot of the people that are in the industry. So it was a good tie in there. The other reason I liked to vote, and niche has always a little bit antithetical to what the thread that's gone through my professional career. I actually like a lot of diversity in the things that I do. And you know, originally when you think of niche, you think of a very defined, very specific area. And you know, my original thought was, well, I like to work with a lot of different people, a lot of different types of people, and I have a really broad skill set. How am I going to kind of, you know, focus on this area? But it serves as a really good way, especially when you're starting out and launching a firm, of, you know, getting yourself a finite universe to actually go and pursue and to, you know, make contact with and be really involved sort of more so than you would be as a generalist. So the fact that I'm able to go and meet some of these people, the fact that a lot of the people that are in those sorts of live event professional roles are actually freelancers. And that is kind of the underlying niche, I guess, if you want to call it, that I really is really my wheelhouse, because I've been a freelancer for the majority of my working life. So I know the challenges that freelancers, I know that they have to wear many, many hats. I know that the there are a lot of opportunities for freelancers as far as taxes, as far as structuring their business, that, you know, regular full-time employees don't have. So I could really serve, you know, those folks well and benefit them. And, you know, those are a lot of the times the people that are familiar with delegating specific responsibilities. So I really like that partnership relationship where someone says, you know, I don't want to deal with this, just tell me what I need to do. And that's great, because that's, if I can't provide somebody with value or, you know, feel like I'm making a difference, it's like, what's the point of working together?
This is so interesting to me, because I think what happens a lot of times when I talk to advisors about a niche, and a lot of them are really averse to it, is they say, well, I don't want to have to turn people away. And I think what the endemic fear is what they're really saying when they say that, Todd, is I don't think I'm going to be able to make enough money or get enough clients in this niche and I think it's just because people don't look deep enough. Michael Kitsis came on my podcast a few years ago, and he talked about some guy who focused on this target market of bass fishermen, not just fishermen, and I'm sorry, because I just said the word fishermen. It should be really fisher people or bass fishers. I apologize, everybody, but that was the way it was said to me. But anyways, he focused on this niche of bass fishers, and Michael said he just didn't even realize that there are like $1 million prize purses. When you think about it, I think as financial advisors, a lot of times they're taught to look for the rich careers, like the doctors, the lawyers, the business owners. And it's not that those aren't great to pursue, but there are people making money as freelancers, because I love how you had the courage to work with freelancers, because a lot of times people say, do freelancers have any money? And it's like such a ridiculous presumption. I mean, of course, some of them don't, and some of them do, and a lot of them do, but you're not looking for the whole world. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to do business with every single freelancer. You just have to to build a practice. I would love to see advisors just focus on 50 to 70 clients, have a deep relationships with them, do a good job, have the relationships be profitable and be correct for the firm. And to do that, you don't need a huge niche. It could actually be a very small niche, but one that you really understand. And it sounds like you really understood because of your wife's profession and then also your background in it. So I love that you were able to like see past the veil, so to speak, that so many people do not look past.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing too, is there's you know, in that traditional, and I've worked at firms before where obviously the main pursuit is gathering assets. I mean, that's how those advisors are compensated. That's how those firms are compensated. And what ends up happening is there's this massive whale hunt, right? People are focusing on just the same, 7 or 8% of the population that have sizable amount of assets. And the focus on that niche takes me out of that. Naturally, I was moving away from that anyway, because my idea was, I don't care how many assets you have. There's a planning that everybody needs, right? And, when you take yourself out of that sort of mindset of, well, I'm only going to work with people who have, $500,000 or more of investable assets. I can't tell you the number of people I've encountered that was their only experience with a financial advisor. Is, the message saying, well, I only work with people with at least $500,000 of investable assets. It's like, I'm making $220,000 a year, but I don't have, that amount. Nobody's even going to talk to me, right? I want to talk to you.
Oh, no, that's not true. The people that'll want to put you in A share mutual funds will talk to you.
I am.
Or some financial advisors, they would
no
say,
argument there.
I'll work with you, but it's going to cost you 1.5%.
Right.
So for $11,000 a year. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that, yes. And I believe that some people refer to this as advice only, the advice only movement.
Yeah, the advice only or a flat fee or any of those sorts of things. That's, that is, as you know, a burgeoning sort of area of the finance industry. And it's really, obviously born out of this idea of, I have somebody with $1 million portfolio versus someone with a $10 million portfolio. Am I really doing exponentially more work for that amount of money that's being generated off that, traditional AUM model? No, there's, a fixed amount of time, and depending on the complexity of the person's situation, there's a tangible value you can put on the work that you're actually doing for somebody. And that makes it more accessible for a lot of people. I can tell you this, I have people come to me that are outside of my niche completely, simply because they're looking for a fee-only arrangement. And it's amazing too, because I'll tell you, and this is obviously really a small universe because it's only people I've dealt with, but a vast majority of those people are, in their 20s and 30s and haven't, I guess maybe aren't as jaded about what their experiences with the finance industry have been in the past. So they have a really good idea. They may be in accumulation mode. I mean, they're definitely in accumulation mode. They may not be asset rich, but they have really good incomes. They've got a lot of potential. They got complexity. They have, stock options. They have ownership in companies. They have, all these different things. And they've recognized that, hey, I want to manage my own assets. I want to do, whatever. I want to speculate and, buy stocks. I'm young. I can blow out all my money if I want, and I can still be fine. But I need help with this. I need help, on exercise strategies for my stock options. I need help with, planning for taxes. I need help with, where am I going to buy a property? What are the implications of this? Now, I mean, really the things that planners dig into, or really should dig into, as opposed to, here's a portfolio of, ETFs, and, let's spend half our time talking about, your investment management.
Right. I hear you. I mean, I know a lot about this. I just had a few people on the podcast that were, Rick Ferry and Andy Panko. And yeah, definitely. I mean, I can't say enough about that. So I love that that's, again, a very non-traditional approach. And it sounds like it's worked out quite well. So what would you say have been the advantages and disadvantages of focusing on a target market as you have?
The advantages are that it, as I said before, it gives you, I was a musician for years and years and years. My undergraduate degree was music. One of the things about music is that you learn that form is a very important part. And what form does, when you think about music, there are an infinite number of decisions you can make. But eventually, get out of the inertia, you have to make a decision on something. You have to make a decision on notes in the melody. You have to make a decision on the harmonies. You have to make, these.
Hold on. I'm just so intrigued. I am also a musician. What instrument?
I was a bass player, and I did orchestra conducting as well, and composition and theory and all that.
Right.
Sort of stuff.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, like I was saying, the form is, and decision making, give you a structure to work within. Otherwise, how would you make decisions on things? I mean, with an infinite number of decisions that you could make, you have to kind of constrain it. You have to have it, plotted out in front of you. And that's similar with the niche, is that, you're not trying to speak to everybody. You're trying to target a very specific area. And then you can focus more so on that particular area, on the issues that those particular people face, on the best ways to serve that community. It's not at the expense of a, diversity or a breadth of knowledge. It's that, I have 10 years of doing this. I've worked with a lot of different types of clients. I've done things that most advisors would never even touch because they actually require work. So I'm not, applying all that information to every single person I work with. But that's one of the great things about it, is that everybody's got their unique financial footprint. And, I'm somewhat of a critic about the sort of catch-all, personal finance gurus, that you see on TV or here on podcasts or whatever. And, they start out from a very broad place and don't go much further than that because they can't, It's those catch-all kind of things don't apply to everybody. Everybody's got a different situation. And that's really kind of what drives me about this work, is I like that. I like that sort of, becoming an expert on one thing and then moving off to the next thing and, really digging in to some of the stuff, because it's interesting.
What do you think has been hard about having this niche strategy?
It's time. This takes time. You can't, maybe you can. I think in probably the majority of situations, when you establish a niche, it's a long game. I mean, it takes a long time to sort of build relationships, to build trust. I mean, if you are working with people that have known you for years and years and years, I remember as a first year advisor, the majority of my clients were people I'd known for years and years and years who, knew my integrity, trusted me, knew my, abilities, and were willing to hand over their, portfolios, for example, even though I was a new advisor. So those sorts of things are very, very hard to synthesize without taking a lot of time to kind of develop them. So that's probably the hardest part, is just, you have those moments. And freelancers are going to be familiar with this because they all go through it. It never changes. It's like you get to those lulls where you go, you don't have a lot of work, or you're not particularly busy, and you think, oh no, maybe I should be doing something else. Maybe I should go get a job. Maybe I should, it's the cycle that all freelancers are familiar with.
Maybe I should go get a job.
I need a job. I'm going to work for somebody else. And you know, I was just talking to one of my clients, and she, you know, she was saying, I really don't want to go get a job. I absolutely don't want to go get a job. But she was, you know, worried that she wasn't going to be able to make the, she was transitioning back to freelance. And, you know, she, it's something that she had done for 20, 25 years, yet she was still, you know, panicking that she wasn't going to be able to make it work. So, you know, it's one of those things that I'm, you know, intimately familiar with, and a lot of times never gets much easier for freelancers. So yeah, it's one of the ways that I can be supportive with the people that I work with, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, when you focus this way, there's not only your understanding of the nuts and bolts of their finances, but there's also that peripheral knowledge, that overarching familiarity with the sphere that they live in. Knowing the same people that they know, or knowing the goings-ons and reading the publications. And what I've seen is that you might have knowledge of some little pocket that they actually might not. In some ways, you might know their world better than them from certain angles. And you just don't really get that when you have a less uniform kind of a practice.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, and, you know, another piece that sort of factored into this niche was the pandemic, because it put that whole industry, the live event industry, into turmoil. And a lot of people were forced out of the industry entirely because of their whatever, I mean, food and beverage people. How are they going to make a pivot to another sort of branch of their specialty in a virtual capacity? You know, people that were producers, a lot of them were able to make the switch to virtual and sort of piece together that kind of, you know, existence until the live events could return and they could get back to doing what they were doing. But again, a lot of people were forced out of that industry. And it was a good time to, I guess, sort of illustrate the idea for that community of, hey, you know, you never know when the next pandemic is going to come along and you're going to have to make some sort of changes. Don't you think, having gone into that pandemic, that if you had worked really closely with a planner who had, you know, illustrated these things, mapped them out, stress tested, done all these different sorts of things, wouldn't it have been a much less, at the very least, a much less stressful time than it was? So I have that conversation with people. But yeah, it is, you know, an industry that is roaring back, obviously, and people are really, really happy to be going back to it. So
how did you come up with the name?
Cadenza?
Musical.
Yeah, music, right? So that had to be part of, I mean, that was, I think, just fundamental to...
For the non-musicians, what is a cadenza in music?
Cadenza is a piece, it's a part of a piece of music, usually like a concerto you might think of, for example. And it's the portion, usually towards the end of the piece, that the soloist, it's a piano soloist, a violin soloist, whatever, has their sort of solo, right? Usually by itself, you know, the rest of the orchestra is quiet, and it's kind of a opportunity for that soloist to sort of display their virtuosity. So they're, you know, usually it's, you know, soloists with the orchestras are pretty highly trained and pretty, you know, pretty talented. So that's their opportunity to sort of show their virtuosity. And I thought that was a kind of a good thing. You know, cadenza, it's my ability to show off my virtuosity. I remember being at firms before and getting to a point where I had to spend, you know, 95% of my time prospecting for new business and maybe 5% with clients. And I thought, you know, I don't mind prospecting, but I don't think I'm doing anybody any favors by spending all my time being a salesperson. It's like, you know,
right.
I want to do the work, right? So, you know, that was the expectation when, you know, I set out to do this, was there was going to be an inordinate amount of time, like trying to find people to work with. But it's balanced. It's much more balanced than it's ever been. So it's good.
All right, Todd. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.